now look upon our speaker to provide his remarks regarding the Genesis flood, a warning for today. Matthew.
When we look on the background of the slide there, that picture of the sea there, and you can just imagine the currents that are beneath the surface there, the churning, turbulent water. We get a kind of a picture of what the water must have been like, which engulfed the earth. It's one of those things, water, which we all depend on, but yet in large volumes is just something well beyond man's control, even with all of modern technology. The only thing that the people were able to do in New York, who recently were in the areas affected by the recent hurricane, all they could do was just flee. Just get away as far as they could from the encroaching water of the Atlantic. We may have some of us seen some of the footage of the tsunamis which hit Asia recently. We've had two devastating tsunamis in a short period of time, and you see the footage and you just realize that there's nothing that man can do to stop it, as that vast volume of water just spreads inland and taking out everything in its way. We can well imagine the devastation of the Genesis flood. Now, we as Christadelphians obviously believe in the flood, but in 2 Peter 3, we realize that the claim that there wasn't a flood is not new. Peter said in 2 Peter 3 that, knowing this first, verse 3, there shall come in the last days scoffers, walking after their own lusts and saying, where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of the creation. For this they willingly are ignorant of, that by the word of God the heavens were of old, and the earth standing out of the water and in the water, whereby the world that then was being overflowed with water perished. The heavens and the earth, which are now by the same word, are kept in store, reserved unto fire against the day of judgment and perdition of godly men. Have you ever heard that claim, that things have continued as they were from the beginning of creation? Maybe not in those words per se, I've heard them, but we know that out there are many people who might reject completely the story of creation and the story of the flood. They might also completely accept, in at least in words, the authority of the scriptures, but they make out that the flood was just a story, just a nice little lesson to teach us something. It does teach us something. It teaches us that God will recompense evil. In Zephaniah, the prophet referred to people in his day who said, the Lord will not do good, neither will he do evil. The Genesis flood shows us that God will do good, and he will do evil. Now, the period of unbelief we're living in today, where probably the majority of people in this country don't believe this flood we're going to talk about, and the majority of Christians, even if they do believe in the Bible, might possibly reject the Genesis flood as a literal occurrence. This period of unbelief tells us that the warning of the Genesis flood is most gravely needed now. In the last days would come scoffers walking after their own lusts and saying, where is the promise of his coming? In that time, Peter said that the heavens and earth which are now would be reserved unto fire against the day of judgment and perdition of godly men. What we will find when we look into this subject is that there will be similarities between the antediluvian society and the modern society. Noah's time was a time of unbelief, wherein, says Peter, 8 souls were saved. 8 souls went into the ark. We don't know what the population was at the time, but what we do know is that there were 1,656 years before the flood came after Adam. Some people have estimated that there would have been about 11 billion people living on the earth at the time, we can't really say for sure. One thing we do know is that people were living for a lot longer then, so the modern reproduction rates are probably not something to work with. It could be that if people were living, as the Bible says, up to 600 years or so, that the population was greater. What the Genesis flood then teaches us is that there are few that be saved, and the vast majority of people in the world are wanting to follow the impulses of the flesh. And it's only God's interruption in judgment which stops mankind just degenerating the whole world and everything in it into a cesspit of wickedness. Romans chapter 6 says, "What fruit had he then in those things whereof ye are now ashamed? For the end of those things that was in serving sin before they took on the name of Christ, the end of those things," he said, "is death." Verse 23, "The wages of sin is death, but the gift of God is eternal life through Jesus Christ our Lord." Sin and death are cause and effect according to the scripture. And of course all sinners would die, and it's through God's mercy only that anyone can be saved. But as a general principle, the greater the sin, the greater the infliction of judgment that comes upon mankind. The last book of the Bible, the book of Revelation, is a book of symbol which in summary tells about what God was going to do to the persecutors of his servants throughout the 2,000 years which would lead up to Christ's second coming. The book of Revelation is a book really about judgment. God will judge the earth. He has judged the earth, and he's going to do it again. We're going to look at this subject in this way. We're going to have a look at evidence of the flood, because it's interesting to have some of this ammunition against a world of wanton disbelief in the things of the Bible. So we're going to look at some of the other accounts of the flood, and we can only scratch the surface. There are many, many other traditions of a global flood throughout the world, which would probably give us enough information to occupy the whole of this address. Then we're going to look at fossils and bones, and mammoths, and the astronomy and physics, and lastly geology. And in all those things we're going to find evidence of the flood, which will give us those warnings for our modern generation. I'm going to look at why the flood came, and this is, I suppose, at the core of the purpose of this address, how that flood serves as a lesson for our modern world, what similarities there were between the ancient antediluvian world and the modern 21st century world. And finally, which we're not going to go into in a great deal of detail, there will be, once again, the time when the earth will be engulfed in a conflagration, when God will once again uproot sin and iniquity and reinstitute righteousness and peace on earth again. Now, the first thing which we're going to bring to witness is this year, I stole one from the Bible exhibit, the Hengoi Bible exhibit, which is right here. There's no one actually, I don't think, who's turned up from the world around us, but this is a particularly interesting artifact replica which we've got here, and many of us will of course be well familiar with it. It's just worth a glance. What it is a story of a flood. It was discovered in Nineveh. It's actually a Babylonian chronicle. But it's remarkable how well that little account from the Babylonian record correlates with the scriptures. Because most of us will be familiar with the Bible account, we'd be able to instantly see some of the the commonalities here. And I'll read through the slides. It says, pull down the house, build a ship, leave riches, seek life, spurn possessions in order to stay alive. Take the seed of all creatures aboard the ship. The ship you are to build, its measurements shall equal each other. Its width and its length shall be the same. I'm starting to see already that there's a great deal of similarity between the Genesis 6 account we read in our introductory reading and what we find here on this tablet, what's called the Epic of Gilgamesh. The other thing just to note from an archaeological point of view is this, that some may have made the attempt to say that the Babylonians inherited their flood account from the exiled Jews who they took captive in 600 BC. This was found in Nineveh. This was a Babylonian account found in, a library in Nineveh. So this belongs to an independent source from the Bible. The fixed time arrived, I boarded the ship and closed the door. For 6 days and 7 nights, the wind, the flood, the storm overwhelmed the land. When the seventh day arrived, the storm and flood ceased, the war. I opened the window, light fell upon my cheek. On Mount Nisr, the ship grounded. I sent out a dove, releasing it. The dove went, then came back. No resting place appeared for it, so it returned. Then I sent out a swallow, releasing it. The swallow went, then came back. No resting place appeared for it, so it returned. Then I sent out a raven, releasing it. The raven went and saw the waters receding. It ate, it flew about to and fro, it did not return. I brought out sacrifices and offered them to the four winds. I made a libation on the peak of the mountain. There's enough dissimilarity in the account to make us realize that it is definitely an independent source, but there's far too much commonality for it to be a mere coincidence. We have the dove and the raven mentioned. We don't have the swallow, of course, in the Bible account, but we have the dove and the raven and the libation on the peak of the mountain. All of these sorts of things are familiar to us from the Genesis account. Another very interesting source of evidence is from Babylonian chronology. What we've got here is a table with the time frame from Adam to Noah at the age of the flood, and those are all the names we read in the Genesis record against the names given in the Chaldean account leading up to the flood in their tradition. Now, it's very interesting to look at the difference in time between the records. We're talking about a small difference of a few hundred years, difference in the accounts. So, taking into account the margin of error, what we're talking about is a very similar record from a completely independent source here of those people who were from the beginning up until the flood, from both the Genesis and the Chaldean history. As I said, we could spend a long, long time going through all the traditions. The last one I wanted to bring up is this interesting one for a lot of us here now. It's an early Welsh legend, and it states that once the Lake of Sion burst, flooding all the lands so that everyone was drowned except Doivan and Doivach, who escaped with a pair of every kind of living thing, so that the descendants of this couple restocked with animals derived from those they had saved. It's intriguing. Again, some of these legends or accounts, they have a bit more dissimilarity than others. The Epic of Gilgamesh we've got there is one of the most amazing of all. And as we go further out from the Middle East, in some ways we might find more creeping in of legend and that sort of thing. But generally speaking, that principle of a flood and saving the creatures by taking them aboard an ark is common throughout many, many myths or legends, whatever you want to call them, accounts that are in the traditions of ancient people. Now we're going to look at bones. The And there we have the Dinosaur National Monument in Utah. Many dinosaur monuments have been found. But this one, because it's got such a frequency, a large stock of dinosaur bones, tells us quite a story. We find haphazard deposits of various animals there, and throughout the world there are deposits of animals which are mixed together. We find, as we look in the Agate Springs of Nebraska, that there are the predators and the prey all mixed together, just haphazardly random bones spread out, all signs of a catastrophe. And before I forget, there's also a fish fossil here which is very interesting to have a look at. This one, when I picked it up in the Meteor Crater place in Arizona, it said it was 25 million years old. You find that the millions of years is the explanation for everything in a scientific world of the present. If there's any anomaly, if there's anything confusing, just add a few zeros to the end and that explains it all. The millions of years can work wonders. But however long the fish had been there, what you can see is that fish was rapidly fossilized. You can see, it's interesting to see the curve. It was in an uncomfortable position when it was deposited there. It, in its own way, it tells a little bit of a story, and all we can do is kind of speculate about what was going on when that fish was there. But think about the fact that if an animal drops to the bottom of a bed of a river or an ocean, particularly in a time which, according to everyone, all accepted, according to a time when there was a lot more going on in the ecosystem, there's always something which is willing to tuck into the fish. If we have a carcass run over on the side of the road, there's something which will eat into it, and if it's not just a predator, then eventually the bacteria will consume it completely. We know that if we just leave a fish on a counter for long enough, it'll go, it'll rot away into nothing. But something happened to that fish to very quickly, instantly, put it into its position and preserve it in that way for us to look at it now, many years afterwards. The fossils are proof of catastrophe. A concern in this place, the Dinosaur National Monument in Utah, we read, this was a professor of geology at the University of Alberta. He says, these reptiles whose fossil remains are found in such great abundance along the Red Deer River seem to have been driven together by a common danger and to have perished in the same catastrophe. What he believes is that they had retreated for some reason to a point to get away from a common danger, and this same catastrophe, he says, engulfed them all and they perished. It's also interesting that the dinosaur dynasty were cut off simultaneously world over. So it wasn't just a gradual decline, it was just one incident which just finished them off. Now, many people blame a meteor. They say that a meteor came and somehow it managed to kill the dinosaurs but not everything else. But what we see here is proof of retreating dinosaurs for whatever reason. Again, we're into the realm of deduction here, and we always need to understand when we get views from scientists, when we get views even from myself, what we're doing is interpreting evidence. But the clear indication of the evidence is catastrophe, and the depositing of the muck and filth around them, again, is another indication that it was a flood, more likely than anything else, which brought an end to the dinosaur dynasty. And of course, it's not just the dinosaurs. Here in Agate Springs of Nebraska, we're not seeing dinosaur bones there, we're seeing bones of all kinds of other animals, but we've got the similar thing going on there with just a haphazard deposition of just random bones. What caused the death of the countless individuals in the Stenberg quarry here? He says, this is Stenberg, he says, it's a question not easily answered. The authorities quoted believe that during the Upper Miocene period there were many watercourses separated by slightly elevated divides and broad floodplains. But during a rainy season of unusual duration, the whole region for many miles must have been converted into a series of lakes, and all the animals in the vicinity, after having gathered at the highest points they could find to escape death, must have been finally overwhelmed by some great flood that covered every inch of ground. It's the sort of thing, I'm sure, if you were looking at and you were a creationist, that would send a shudder down your spine just looking and seeing there probably what's a proof of the flood. On this slide, we have what's called Berezovka Mammoth. This was, from what they can tell, it was a 50-year-old male in a freshly eroded bank that they discovered. There's plenty of information which they've managed to gather from this mammoth, and not just this mammoth, but from many other mammoths. There's been several discoveries throughout the more northern regions of the earth where they're most likely to be preserved in ice. Incidentally, not that it matters all that much to how we're interpreting things here, but when you see the pictures of these mammoths in snowy conditions, we're probably getting the wrong picture. Because even though they were woolly, apparently from what they've discovered, it wasn't like a polar bear's sort of coat. It was lighter fur, and if it was the kind of creature which, if it had lain down, it would have melted the snow. It would have lost heat, diffused through its fur or its hair. More than anything, this creature would have needed to eat a phenomenal amount to stay alive, just like a modern elephant. And there's no way that that kind of creature would have been able to sustain itself in modern Siberia, for example, where many of them have been found. As quick as we can, we're going to go through some of these things which prove catastrophe again. There's lots of theories for the mammoths, but none which fit as well as the flood. It must have lived, as we said, in a warm climate, much warmer than modern Siberia today. When we say warm, it's all obviously a relative thing. But something must have happened to Siberia to change the temperatures. Something sudden, not just a gradual change, you know, a climate change where, you know, you've got global warming or global cooling. This was sudden enough to freeze the mammoth instantly. And we say instant, we mean instant, because they found the food still in its mouth and decomposed. And they found in another mammoth, in its stomach, the pine needles and the its recent meal, which hadn't been broken down by the stomach enzymes and acids. So it was an instant thing. They were away from rivers. They were Yudomas and Lurs, I think it's pronounced. They were found in deep positions of muddy, silty deposits. The next one is multicontinental. Yeah, they've been found not just in Siberia, but throughout all the northern areas of the world. They've been found in Alaska as well, and many other such places. So it's not. These would have been at one time a common animal walking upon the earth. Let's move through as fast as we can. They were buried at generally flat, low plateaus. There was frozen muck, as we said, similar to the Yudomas and Lurs. Then there was rock ice, which is a strange sort of granular ice containing clay. Then there's the sudden freezing point, which we've discussed. Now the suffocation, again, is perhaps one of the most interesting ones, or one of the easiest ones for us to grasp without having to go too much into the science of it. They know for certain that this mammoth died of suffocation. And they've got various evidence from rhinoceroses and things like that in a similar area that they died from suffocation. They've got dirty lungs. There was another one, not this one in particular, but one called Dima, another mammoth, which had a digestive and respiratory tract full of silt, clay and gravel. The temperatures must have sunk very quickly down to an estimated minus 150 to have preserved them so well and to preserve the remains of their intestines. The large animal, I've forgotten the significance of that. The semaphore death is interesting in that this wasn't just a sudden change of temperatures in the winter. The food they found in these mammoths proved that it was summertime, because they've looked at the berries and the things they've studied in them show that what they were eating was summer fruits. Summer, maybe at latest autumn. So this wasn't just a sudden cold patch in the winter. This was something drastic and cataclysmic which changed things. Now, there are bones of many types of animals, friends and foes, all frequently found near the mammoths. And they were preserved upright. So that one, that mammoth, which we had on the slide there, Berezovka mammoth, was upright. It wasn't lying down, it wasn't just dropped somewhere, it was upright. And it was compressed in this vertical position. Like there's a crushed leg on the vertical, on the mammoth. And these are some of the things which we find from looking at the wide range of mammoths. And I'll try and just curtail most of the deductions we get from it, but just say this, that the only evidence, the only theory which explains all the evidence there is a flood which instantly brought destruction upon these mammoths, suffocated them, killed them, preserved them, and then something must have happened to affect the temperature of Siberia at the time and Alaska and those northerly quarters, which we'll come on to a bit later. So mammoths are a proof of the flood. There we have some other fossils. Now if you look carefully at this fossil, what you'll see is within the fish, a fish. So this one had been preserved before it had time for its digestive system to break down the fish. The second there in some ways shows a bit more clearly that there's a fish within. So this didn't have millions of years to turn into a fossil. It was an instant thing. Literally less than a 24-hour thing, this thing was fossilized. This is a 1.5 foot long dragonfly wing. Again, as much as proving the same thing, what this tells us a little bit about is the antediluvian world. A very different world. I think I read somewhere that the insects take in oxygen through their wings. And in the modern world, a creature like this wouldn't be able to live. There wouldn't be enough oxygen in the air to maintain its existence. Don't quote me on it, but I think that's how it is. But just imagine the size on this dragonfly. And it maybe gives us some insight into what a world would have been like in the pre-Adamic era, pre-Noahic era. a little bit of astronomy here, which ties into that last slide. Our Earth moves around the sun and rotates. It spins, a 24-hour thing to give us day and night. It spins at an axis of 23.5 degrees. So whilst it's going around the sun, it's at a 23.5 degrees axis. What this means is that most of the world gets a fair share of light, but we know that the Antarctic and Arctic areas get very little light, because when the light is hitting those areas, it's diffused over a larger area at the north and the south. Now, there was a man, George Dodwell, who served as the government astronomer for South Australia from 1909 to 1952. And in the 1930s, he became interested in the changes in the tilt of the Earth's axis. Now, what he discovered, he collected about 100 historic and precise measurements covering 4,000 years. What he discovered was that the tilt of the Earth had smoothly decayed from 25 degrees to its current position of 23 degrees. So its tilt at one time was greater than it was now. What that would mean is that the Tropic of Capricorn and the Tropic of Cancer and Capricorn would have been more north and south, that the sunlight would have been diffused over, would have been shared over a larger area of the Earth. It would mean that the Earth would have been less likely to produce a Sahara Desert along the equator. And it would have meant that there would have been more warmth spread to those areas, such as in Siberia and so on and so forth. So vegetation would have had more chance of succeeding, like we find today in the Amazon rainforests and those sort of areas north and south of the equator. At the moment, most of our oxygen comes, believe it or not, from the sea. We'd think it'd be plants, but most of the Earth's oxygen comes from phytoplankton, which is plankton sitting on the sea, which emits oxygen. I believe that probably when God created the Earth, there would have been enough vegetation, there would have been enough trees and plants around the Earth, and a far stronger ecosystem to have brought more oxygen throughout the Earth. And the position of the Earth in relation to the sun would have meant that there would have been less areas with an intense concentration of sunlight and less areas with a smaller concentration of light, just as we've got today in Arctic and Antarctic. But before we move on, in many ways the most interesting thing that Dodwell discovered was, from the shape of his decay curve, the decay curve of the Earth's axis, his estimate was that the axis shift began in about the year 2345 BC, which was round about when the flood was. It's one of those things which again probably indicates that our theorising there is right about the fact that the antediluvian world would have been quite different to ours. We have a picture there of a Grand Canyon, which is another piece of evidence for catastrophe. Now, you talk to any modern day geologist and they will tell you that the Colorado River carved out the Grand Canyon. The Grand Canyon is deep, a matter of miles deep. It's a matter of many miles in breadth, like 45 miles in breadth. That's a pretty big river, the Colorado River. Is it really big enough to carve that out? You can look at the canyon and you think, well, is that the usual shape, the usual V shape of a river? And where's all the banks, where's all the mud and the silt that's usually deposited by a river? It's not there. The Grand Canyon tells us about something which swept it out with great speed and great momentum, so that whatever deposits there might have been, whatever silt, whatever dirt was scooped out of the canyon, was taken away and dropped somewhere else, not in the canyon. What could have done it? The geologists, as we said, can only think of the river. As creationists, we find an excellent explanation in Noah's flood. Or if it wasn't Noah's flood, at least remains left on high altitude by Noah's flood, which then maybe broke their banks and with great discharge carved all this out. Now, just want to speak a little bit about carbon-14 and coal, because coal is believed to be prehistoric remains compressed. I have to make a confession. I used this slide before and I got it wrong. I said that carbon-14 degenerated into another isotope of carbon. According to what I read, it doesn't. It decays into nitrogen. Anyhow, the carbon-14 principle goes like this. Carbon-14 will decay, and in 5,730 years, 1 gram of carbon-14 will become half a gram of carbon-14. Because half of them will have decayed into nitrogen-14. Anyway, what it means, we're talking about a small time as atoms go, 5,730 years, not that long really. And carbon-14 is very uncommon. So it's like, I don't know the exact number, but it's a millionth of all carbon in the world, a fraction of all the carbon. So to find carbon-14 in coal probably tells us that a lot of the coal remains which we dig out, the coal which we dig out and burn on our fires, is remains of a pre-flood era. Yeah, we don't need to go into too much detail, but it's been found in diamonds as well as coal. And it tells us a story, again, like all the others, of a catastrophe which ended up depositing some of those people with plants, whatever it was, and left them for us to use as coal and oil. Now here's another interesting one. You can see there that's like a fallen log, a fallen tree. It is, but it's in a petrified wood. If you go into this national park, it will tell you as you're going in that it's millions of years old. I actually have some here, which again is interesting to look at. This is probably wood from the time of Adam to Noah. Preserved because of special conditions, they reckon that probably volcanoes might have had something to do with it, but ash and water, it's silica and water is what's needed. Nothing, it doesn't need millions of years because it's happened in the eruption of Mount Vesuvius, I think it was. They've had exactly the same thing replicated. But this year just needs silica and water to be preserved and petrified, as they call it, for us today. And the point we're driving at here is that there's water which has given us that they're fossilized wood. And it's another proof of something that's happened, something unusual, which has been strong enough to raise those logs, to preserve them in that way, to petrify them in that way, and to give them the great volume we've got in some of those areas. It's the southern states of USA. Right, we've gone through a lot of that stuff, and we ought to spend some time concentrating on the scriptures, as it's the lesson which we've got to draw from all that is what's really of use to us. Now let's have a look at our introductory reading in Genesis chapter 6 verse 2. And while we're turning that up, that slide you've got there is human footprints. You can actually see the soles of the foot. Now, zoomed in there, you've got a trilobite. Now a trilobite is the thing which is right at the bottom of the evolution. You've probably seen these tables, the evolutionary tables, where you've got, you know, Jurassic period, Palaeolithic period, whatever it is, and then you go all the way down, right at the bottom you've got Cambrian. In the Cambrian epoch lived the trilobites. They died out and then came along the dinosaurs and blah blah blah, and then came man with his flint and whatever else. Well, here we've got on the shoe of a human a trilobite, which is enough in itself there to write off that, all those evolutionary tables you see in the school textbooks. It's all summarily a load of nonsense. So there we have probably two footprints of an antediluvian man. Let's have a look in Genesis 6 verse 2. The sons of God saw the daughters of men that they were fair, and they took them wives of all which they chose. Here we have the dividing line between evil and good being broken down. It was principally marriage. What we see from the fruits of the fraternity of good and evil, and the failure of mankind to draw that distinction between right and wrong and to keep separate from wickedness, we get this result in verse 5. God saw the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. The earth, verse 11, was corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. And God looked upon the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted his way upon the earth. And God said unto Noah, the end of all flesh is come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them, and behold, I will destroy them with the earth. Peter says in his second epistle, chapter 2 and verse 5, he says that God brought the flood upon the world of the ungodly. Now, this world of the ungodly, they weren't all Rosemary Sutcliffe's, Ian Huntley's, Fred West's. These were people who lived life to the full, much like probably we'd see it today. We don't get too much told about this 656 years before the flood, but in chapter 4 we get most we do know about the children of men, the wicked people. And it's worth having a read of Genesis 4. And this was the descendants of Cain. And Cain begat Lamech, verse 19. Lamech took unto him two wives, the name of the one was Ada, and the name of the other Zillah. And the name of the other was Zillah. And Ada bare Jabal. He was the father of such as dwell in tents, and of such as have cattle. And his brother's name was Jubal. He was the father of all such as handled the harp and organ. And Zillah, she also bare Tubal-Cain, an instructor in every artificer in brass and iron. And the sister of Tubal-Cain was Naamah. What we're seeing here, we're not told of anything, we're not told any gory details of the violence of these people yet. What we are told is that they were successfully engaged in the things of this life. And the account goes on and says, Lamech said unto his wives, hear my voice, ye wives of Lamech, hearken unto my speech, for I have slain a man to my wounding and a young man to my hurt. In other words, he had been wounded and hurt, and in recompense he slew the man. He said, if Cain shall be avenged sevenfold, truly Lamech 70 and sevenfold. So it was a rebellious disregard of God, just as we see in modern society. And here's where we need to start drawing the lessons. Let's move to Luke chapter 17. Luke chapter 17, verse 26. Jesus says, "As it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be also in the days of the Son of Man. They did eat, they drank, they married wives, they were given in marriage, until the day that Noah entered into the ark, and the flood came and destroyed them all." Again, Christ doesn't talk about the fact that they were violent, there was lots of killing in and out. He says, they did eat, they drank, they married wives, given in marriage. They were absorbed in the pleasures of this life and taking no thought for God. What about our modern world? Christ then says, he will come at a time like the days of Noah. And the question for us then to consider, are there any modern trends which are similar to the days of Noah? Is man's heart evil continually? It's a difficult thing to measure. You can't go around with a questionnaire and say, is your thought evil continually? But what we do know is from man's interests, from his excitement, from all that he does, that his affections and his interests are for things that are wicked. We look at TV and computer games, and these really give us a good measure of man's evil imaginations. If based on these alone, then we can conclude that violence, vice, immorality are the things which delight our modern era. And we can't measure society on the isolated incidents of some of those way out wicked people, as we mentioned, like the Ian Huntleys or Fred West or this recent guy in Aberystwyth. What the account tells us is that all flesh had corrupted his way. It wasn't just one or two wicked people. That's not the measure. It's whether society at large is forgetting God, forgetting his way. Has God's way been corrupted in the modern world? Evolution, which we've mentioned a couple of times in this lecture, has done its fair share of destroying man's faith in the Bible. I was told of someone who gave a program on the BBC called History of the World. His name was Andrew Marr. And he said that the Bible was wrong because it had said that the earth was fixed on its foundations. He didn't bother to mention the fact that the Bible said that the earth hung upon nothing, or even attempt to explain it. We're in the world of the ungodly. Depart from us, we desire not the knowledge of thy ways. The crime of the modern world is like the crime of Belshazzar. As Daniel said to him, the God in whose hand thy breath is and whose are all thy ways, hast thou not glorified? They will meet a similar fate to Belshazzar. God said to Noah that he would never flood the earth again. But he will use other means of punishing the wicked, as he has done since. We read in Jeremiah chapter 25 that God is going to plead with all flesh, and once again judgment is going to fall upon the world of the ungodly. Jeremiah 25 verse 31, a noise shall come even to the ends of the earth, for the Lord hath a controversy with the nations. He will plead with all flesh. He will give them that are wicked to the sword, saith the Lord. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, behold, evil shall go forth from nation to nation, and a great whirlwind shall be raised up from the coasts of the earth. And the slain of the Lord shall be at that day from one end of the earth even to the other end of the earth. They shall not be lamented, neither gathered nor buried. They shall be done upon the ground. So just like we saw those slides of deposition of animals haphazardly, we're going to see human flesh again meet a similar fate. Not with a flood, but by God's other means of destruction. Ezekiel 38 refers to them, and we won't turn it up, but it speaks of earthquakes, the sword, pestilence, blood, rain, great hailstones, fire, brimstone. All these things God will use to execute his judgments. And concerning those who, as we said, in the introduction, the Lord will not do good, neither will he do evil. The answer to those is, the Lord will do good, and he will do evil. Every man in this room, every man in this country, every man from one end of the earth to the other will be affected by the coming of Christ, for good or bad. And every person will stand related to either the goodness or the severity of God. And it's for us to decide on which side of God's judgments we come. The last verse we'd like to turn to is in Malachi, which speaks of Christ's coming judgment when he comes a second time. Malachi chapter 3. Now he called the proud happy, verse 15. Yea, they that work wickedness are set up. Yea, they that tempt God are even delivered. Afterwards, verse 18, it said, then shall he return and discern between the righteous and the wicked, between him that serveth God and him that serveth him not. For behold, the day cometh that shall burn as an oven, and all the proud, yea, all that do wickedly shall be stubble. And the day that cometh shall burn them up, saith the Lord of hosts, that it shall leave them neither root nor branch. But unto you that fear my name shall the Son of Righteousness arise with healing in his wings, and he shall go forth and grow up as calves of the stall. He shall tread down the wicked, for they shall be ashes under the soles of your feet in the day that I shall do this, saith the Lord of hosts.